You're listening to The Stack, first broadcast on the 29th of September 2012 on Monocle 24. The Stack is brought to you in association with J.Crew.
Online Goes Offline in a magazine from Australia, a Japanese title with a very particular aesthetic, an editor who likes to take things slowly, and a designer with a gently expanding portfolio. All that and quite a bit more today on The Stack. Also on this edition of The Stack, we head to Berlin to speak to one of the biggest names in international typography, Eric Speakerman.
Most clients, quite frankly, want more of the same. I've yet to meet newspaper journalists that really have guts. Most newspapers, especially newspaper people or magazine people, are very, very scared of the news, so they go for a tried model.
And we head to London's East End to meet a group of people who don't mind getting geeky about the look, feel, and smell of great paper stock.
It was a lightweight cover material, but it's a sort of an uncoated type of hybrid material for the cover. It was 200 gram, which was fairly light. The material actually flowed very nicely. It wasn't too flicky.
Pages of reasons to stay tuned over the next hour to edition 5 of The Stack. Hello and welcome to this fifth edition of The Stack, Monocle 24's program devoted to those who like putting ink to paper with regular frequency or simply consuming it. Today we'll be looking at Sumu, one of my favorite magazines from Japan, addressing the issue of typography as a barometer of our culture and hopefully introducing you to some new reads for your desk, coffee table, or tote. But first, our guests. And we start by welcoming a man who takes pride in being the last to write about breaking news. It's Rob Orchard, the director of the Slow Journalism Company, the organization behind the publication of Delayed Gratification. Should I leave a long, pregnant pause before we start?
I think so. Leave it about 3 months and then I'll come back and tell you what I do.
Excellent. For those who aren't familiar with the title, first, what was the starting point for it and where can people access it?
Absolutely. So it's a magazine which prioritizes print and perspective. So it's come out of a group of guys who've worked together editorially for a long time and have had all of those conversations in the pub about what their dream magazine would be and how the magazines that they're working on at the time are awful for this reason, so let's cut that out, and sort of all of those different things. And what we do is, every quarter, every 3 months, we draw a line in the sand and we return to the news of that quarter and we pick out what we think was important and we revisit it with the benefit of hindsight. And often we find that stories have moved on a lot. Often we find that people who had one opinion in the heat of the moment have got a very different opinion a bit later on. And we also do a lot of very beautiful infographics where we pull together data from those 3 months and see new stories emerging. And we're all big lovers of print, so we wanted something that looked and felt and smelled good as well. And so we launched Delayed Gratification 2 years ago. We sell mainly through our website. We've got a few retail outlets that we sell through as well. That's about it.
Excellent. Also around the table, Will Hudson is the founder and director of It's Nice That, which bucked an industry trend by starting out as a blog before establishing itself as a much respected art and culture magazine. Do you think that you were one of the first to do that? Because we've been talking about this over the last few weeks, Will, about this amazing, you know, migration. Everyone talked about, you know, how blogs, of course, were going to, you know, replace magazines, etc. And then we've seen so many interesting sort of niche titles go on to the printed page now.
We started a blog because I was at university, I was a final year student and didn't have any money. So it was around the time that blogging became so much more accessible. A guy called Jez in the year below just programmed the website. We got it underway, grew very organically, and it was 2 years later that we printed the first magazine. And what's funny about the magazine is it kind of makes it real. It kind of takes it out from being that sort of bedroom hobby and actually kind of says, look, here's something. And both myself and Alex, my business partner, we are both graphic design students, so we've both got this sort of energy to want to create something. And print magazines were sort of always something that was on the top of my list to go and create.
This is to both of you. Do you think when something migrates from digital territory and then goes into a print edition, does it broaden the discussion, or do you think then it suddenly becomes more personal? Will, I'll start with you.
In what way? I don't know, the website for us was always just an opportunity to unload stuff. It was, I'm useless at remembering names. It was my way of sort of documenting and bookmarking what I was looking at. The magazine, actually, as soon as you put something into print, you kind of have to think, and actually our editor, Rob, would kill me for saying this, you kind of have to think differently. You kind of have to go, right, here it is, it's in print. I can't, 5 minutes later, I can't go in and edit this. There's a higher attention to detail. There's the photography we commission or the writers we commission. You do with a little bit more consideration, or at least certainly back then.
Rob, there is that sense of getting it. You really have to sort of get it right. Not the first time, because you can look at it on the wall again and again, but there is a moment, that crucial moment, where the chrome lens go round and that thing's getting shipped off to the printer.
Absolutely right. And we felt that very strongly, because we've always pitched ourselves as either being a very, very slow magazine or a very, very fast history book. And like Monocle, our magazines are designed to be collected and to be kept and to be kind of stored up and almost form a contemporary history of the world. And you're right. You can't revise it. I mean, we have a slightly awkward relationship with online insofar as our philosophy is effectively set up to counter the speed of online journalism, the speed of fast media, the tweeting from courtrooms, the putting up one story and then realising you got it wrong, but you put it up so fast, and then you need to put down exactly the opposite story a couple of minutes later. But then also, by the same token, obviously online is the best way to reach people and the best way to sample to people and intrigue people. And this battle has played out on our website, which we're just about to relaunch for that reason.
One of the big challenges we have, though, is because we've built up this big online audience, to then try and stick a £10 magazine under their nose. Mm-hmm. It's that much more difficult, because we know we still have people that kind of go, it's a printed blog. And actually, it's not. The last two magazines have been solely new content. Mm. But it's trying to sell that in. And actually, I think some of the more successful magazines like Apartmento, actually have no online presence whatsoever and kind of go, look, we're a magazine, this is who we are, this is when you can expect to see us. Mm. And I think that, and we've contemplated how we go about changing the magazine. Do you change the name? And actually, that's what you sell into people, and it happens to be published, but it's nice that. Mm. But it's one of the big challenges we have is from our audience, people look at it and go, well, I can kind of get this for free every day. Mm.
Do you think that's going to be a defining feature as we continue to, of course, see the march of digital, but that periodicals are going to almost have to define themselves by the exclusivity of just solely being paper and ink. And as you're saying, maybe actually not even having a portal. Maybe beyond just promotion, where to find us, but otherwise that's it.
Exactly right, just the shop front, and that was always our kind of thinking about it, and that as the digital media marches on ever faster, actually what's opening up at the back end is an opportunity to be everything that that's not. And some magazines are kind of dashing to kind of ape the online media. They're bringing down their production values. They're making their pictures bigger, and they're reducing the editorial staff and so on, and sourcing a lot more online. And then there's others who have sensed this as an opportunity to get back to what people really loved about the printed page. And you've had some interesting discussion on here in the last few weeks about exactly that. So actually, what can print do that online can't? Obviously, it kind of has this lovely kind of tactile quality. There's that lean back factor that everybody's been talking about. But there's also that sort of didactic possibility that your guests were talking about before. The opportunity to explore new territories and tell people about things they never knew they wanted to know about. That serendipity of print as well. So there's all of those different things which I think increasingly print products are going to be hammering in on, zoning in on, because that's what they can do better.
Well, is there also a value equation as well? Because you go to your site and there, it is extraordinary eye candy, and I mean this in a very nice way, but it's just that. And it seems that we're talking to a generation who may not want to spend the £10, and oddly they're always looking at something just through this backlit environment of the screen, but never actually snapping the paper.
Yeah, definitely, without doubt. I think we've actually postponed printing our September issue because we recognised things weren't maybe heading in the direction that we'd hoped. We ran three sort of focus groups where we pulled in our readers, we pulled in people that we knew, and chatted to them about what it was that we were doing. And I think it's those kind of things. And we also were lucky enough to sit down with Paul Smith, and he's the thing that sort of resonated with me that he said, because we were chatting about price, is it about just trying to make it so much more accessible? He actually said, no, just make it worth £10. Just go and produce something that people will spend £10 on. I think I read a piece that you wrote recently, which was the differentiate or done. And I think it's exactly that. I think it's if someone can go and buy a magazine very similar to It's Nice That for half the price, they're going to go and buy that magazine. We need to make sure that our point of difference is big enough that either our readers that maybe want to engage with it, or people that walk into a newsagent's and see it for the first time, look at it and say, yes, that's what I want to go and spend £10 on, and I'm happy to spend that money.
I have to ask the question, when are you going to go on press? And what are you adding in terms of value?
The next issue will be printed in March. Mm. We are now starting to look at exactly what that issue will consist of. We're chatting to printers to talk about formats, to talk about stock. I think the attention to detail and the sort of finish is imperative. Mm. I think it's a magazine. And we talk about magazines in this way, is that you buy the magazine and read it, and I hope everyone that buys it sticks on the shelf. You can revisit the magazine. No one revisits the blog. No one goes, oh, I'm now going to go and read October 2009 and then revisit that. It's presented in a way that kind of says, look, here is this content, and you can open it up.
Mm. Let's go and explore all things then paper-related, because for most editors, the battle to keep the print industry relevant lies in a deep love of paper. After all, there isn't a touchscreen in the world that can replace the feel, rustle, and smell of a quality page. Earlier in the week, the Church of London, a growing publisher responsible for Huck magazine and Little White Lies, hosted a seminar for London's biggest paper geeks entitled Paperstock. Our Adrian Craddock was there and spoke to two key speakers, paper merchant Justin Hobson and Roy Killen, the co-founder of boutique printer Push.
I'm one of three partners who set up Push 7 years ago. We're a printing company, a litho printing company, based in South Bermondsey in London, who work primarily with designers and the wider creative community. We are Push. We're a litho printer, a lithographic printer. Digital printing's changing all the time. It's improving. The run lengths are increasing. The sheet size next year will possibly increase. Digital printing allows you to be much more targeted, having bespoke covers, which is difficult for litho. Litho, I would suggest, is still the best way to produce a quality product. You're creating something in a manufacturing environment, but at the same time, you're trying to make it look beautiful. Mm-hmm. And I think it's the combination of the two that interests me. One of the things, which is perhaps an unfashionable thing to say, but in print, in paper, in a production piece, if it looks very, we're asked quite a lot to say, well, I want to produce this, but I've got no limited budget. It's a general thing, but if it looks very good, if it's got strong production values, it will come at a value. It has got a cost. It's peculiar to print, but if you're wanting to buy a new model, a new car, and you decided you wanted an Audi, you wouldn't then benchmark it against Skoda prices. You might benchmark against BMW costs, you might benchmark it against Mercedes costs, or Lexus costs or whatever, but you wouldn't benchmark it against something that didn't have the strong production values that what you wanted. That happens a lot in print. Some people will come to us and say, we want you to produce this, but I've got this price that's minus X. Can you do it for minus X? But there's a value to what too many printers haven't invested in producing a strong product, and then in turn invested in a strong price. And it's all to do with being self-confident with what you're doing and developing a niche that answers what people want and getting and being very good at it. And too many people don't celebrate it and endorse it and encourage it. What's the future for papers? That's changing all the time. All it requires is one good publication, one good magazine to get out there using a paper that no one's used before, and that becomes a new trend. I can't, but certainly in the industry generally, runs are reducing, you've got to become more focused, and if I just had somewhat one thing, whatever's printed, it has to have strong production values and be beautiful. Mm. So that is it's become more targeted. It becomes, if you've got a blog and you say click on this to get your copy of the blog or to get your journal, it's got to be doing something more than the blog. It can't just be regurgitating the blog. It's got to be different from the blog. It's got to have its own values.
My name's Justin Hobson. I'm a paper merchant. I work for a company called Fenner Paper. The house magazines for Soho House that MB Studio designed, that was a particular favourite because it was bucking the glossy magazine trend. It had a very innovative use of illustration and the right use of materials. It was a lightweight cover material, but it's a sort of an uncoated type of hybrid material for the cover. But it was 200 gram, which was fairly light, but still gave it a nice... the material actually flowed very nicely. It wasn't too flicky, because again, in my experience, a lot of people, when they're starting off doing magazines, they quite often end up using too heavy a cover weight, which of course has the effect of making it feel more like a brochure and nodding less towards a magazine. I would like to think that most people, even if they're just, you know, somebody off the street, would be able to determine or perceive some sort of quality to a piece, you know, if it was a particularly well considered piece of literature. I mean, not necessarily to go, oh wow, you know, isn't that fantastic in a sort of, you know, paper geeky sort of way, but I do think that there are some ways of conveying quality which I think a lot of people can appreciate. Whether they actually know they appreciate it, as in it's conscious, or whether it's actually subconscious, you know, is debatable. I mean, arguably, I guess, you know, if it's too conscious, then potentially, you know, the paper, the binding, the printing, mm-hmm. may have actually overplayed its part. Because the trouble is that if you're too lavish and inappropriate from that point of view, then actually you can end up where the actual publication itself becomes greater than what it's actually either about or selling or promoting or whatever. I'd put good editorial in with the good paper and the good binding and the good, you know, because ultimately if something feels fantastic and people are very engaged with it, but actually they read it and they think this is a load of rubbish, then at the end of the day it doesn't really, you know, it's fallen flat on its face again, hasn't it? And I think that's where it's all of those things coming together that make the difference. In the same way that you can get something that's pretty shabby, but if it's fantastically written, you will still get people to read it. Probably less people, because some people won't actually think it's worth reading. This old "you can judge a book by its cover" thing is you know, works both ways basically. Mm-hmm. In the main, people would like to get away from ordinariness, if that makes sense. You know. I suppose one of the things is that if you take an ordinary piece of print, so for instance the leaflet that you get through your door from the local pizza delivery company, or the Argos catalogue or the IKEA catalogue, I mean, they are absolutely fantastic pieces of print, you know, from a technical point of view of ink on paper. They may be lacking something in design, they may be lacking something in paper quality necessarily, but from a piece of print and probably photography point of view, they're fantastic. But the trouble is that's raised the bar to mean that, you know, people are very colourblind to a degree, mm-hmm. And they always assume that things are going to be fantastically well produced on effectively fantastic papers. The industry has moved entirely now to a four colour industry, or a full colour industry basically. When I started 25 to 30 years ago, it was still very much a one colour or two colour job is cheaper, you know, four colour, that's really going to be pushing the boat out. You know, we had to scan images, and images were scanned manually on drum scanners and all that sort of thing. Now, because of the digital workflow, which is entirely full colour related, right, it means that effectively everything is set up for four colour, and therefore actually doing something one or two colour is actually a bit of a pain, and actually could end up ironically costing more than doing four colour. So that, along with paper all being pretty good quality wise, means that now, you know, four colour print is everywhere, and as I say, from your pizza leaflet to, you know, everything, you know, even the guy, you know, giving you his, I don't know, minicab card.
And that was Monocle's Adrian Craddock speaking with paper merchant Justin Hobson and Roy Killen, the co-founder of Boutique Printer Push Print at the Church of London's Paper Stock Seminar. And you're listening to The Stack. Now, I just wanted to ask you guys before we go away to a very short break. Do you find also, as we sort of talked about sort of how the market's polarizing, people who are seriously into their business of paper and also print are also becoming... These are seriously passionate chaps that we were listening to there. That sort of sense of sort of being the specialist becomes even more important, you think, Rob?
Absolutely, absolutely. And what you have at the moment is, I think, mirrored in the massive uprise in independent magazines, you know, pushing passion ideas that they have and they've been sitting on for a while. You've also got very, very kind of passionate small scale printers mirroring that.
Mm.
And you know, the rising quality which has been driven by independent magazines is extraordinary in you know, in paper stock and in, you know, in finish and things like that. I mean, I think it's really being pushed by that side rather than the big publishing companies.
Yeah. Well, do you worry that maybe there aren't enough apprentices out there as everyone sort of, again, it's maybe very fashionable to work for a digital firm, and do these guys, are they bringing enough young talent up to the ranks who are really going to understand the craft of actually what it means to be on a print press?
Great question. I honestly don't know. I think I've never heard Justin so calm. Justin is from Fenner is the most enthusiastic person you can possibly meet. I think we run a design agency alongside It's Nice That, and I think the designers that we get in, bit freelancers, bit juniors, I think there's still, and I think you can really tell something about a designer when they go and get the paper stocks and samples and look through them and say it needs to be more this than this. And I think you can really identify someone that's interested and passionate about what they're doing by the things they reference. The other side to that, the people that they then phone up and discuss, I don't know, I guess we do tend to deal with people who are 40 plus, maybe even older than that. You don't get a young voice on the telephone going, yeah, I'll come down and show you these gloss stocks, these uncoated, these whatever. It'll be interesting to see in what direction
I think there's
it moves.
A finishing school to be launched. For sure. Okay, you guys, you've got to go and shuffle your piles of magazines. We're going to go away for a short break. The Stack is back in a moment.
A careful attention to detail helps define the clothing that J.Crew makes. As head menswear designer Frank Mouchens explains, creating the best products often means approaching the design process through an unconventional lens, bringing together the best materials in the world with bold, smart designs.
To us, it's always striving for the best. It's about fit and design and color and fabric, and about working with the best mills and factories in the world. And in men's, you have to be persistent and consistent. All these values get translated by being obsessive about details, whether it's replicating a cool vintage button for a work shirt or shaping the armhole of our Ludlow jacket. So we question all components of a garment, and even the amount of stitches per inch can make a huge difference.
J.Crew.
As the mother of all book fairs in Frankfurt approaches, all next week on Monocle 24 we'll be turning the pages on the world of publishing. From the self-publishing New Yorkers to the Berlin bookhouses who continue to triumph in physical form. We'll explore the challenges and opportunities posed by the digital revolution and assess the impact of new technologies on the bookseller and the publishing house around the world. Plus, we'll hear what there is to look forward to at this year's fair, and we might meet a translator or two as well. That's the publishing series all this week on The Globalist and The Daily, right here on Monocle 24.
And welcome back to The Stack. It is just 18:26 in Tokyo, 12:26 in Beirut, 11:26 in Zurich, 10:26 here at Midori House in London. Gentlemen, I'm not sure about you guys, but do you ever sort of, when you have a fresh pile of magazines, do you engage in sort of a bit of triage? The one that you think, okay, I'm going to read this one now, and I'm actually quite happy to sort of dispense with it and sort of get it out of the way. Then there's sort of the second one that, you might come to in a couple of hours, but there's that other one that you actually leave for days, and you're just waiting for that sort of really sort of perfect moment to crack the spine on it. And well, I'll start with you.
Yes, I buy magazines that sit there for weeks. I don't know. I read it. Rob has one guideline for magazines, which is, can you read it on a bus? Can I read it on the tube? And actually, I've got a 50-minute bus ride to and from work every day, and actually, the majority of time I spend is reading magazines on the bus. I get that excitement when I go to buy magazines, and I buy five or six at a time. They will then live in a stack on the table for a long, long time, and I'll gradually work my way through them. But the majority of the time, it's just flitting from one to the next and dipping in and out. It's not.
But is the one that you give special treatment to, you think, okay, actually, I'm not going to take you on the bus. You're so precious that you're just going to sort of stay home, bedside table.
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
Okay, so which one is, of the titles we've got here, which one is that one?
I have the titles here. Probably our own. Probably It's Nice That. No, I think maybe Port, but just because the production values are a little bit better. Things like I've bought L Decoration, and the FT Weekend magazine are very much more disposable.
Mm.
And actually, it's one of the reasons why I'm really comfortable with them, is because I know their place. They're there to be read, and then I can quite happily get rid of them. They don't have to find that space on the bookshelf.
Let's start then, Rick, from a, we would never want to say or talk about disposability, but certainly something that you can engage with and then move on from. The Weekend FT magazine, where does that sit for you in with periodicals, in sort of the supplement pile with newspapers in the UK? From a design point of view, but also content?
Design point of view, I think it's excellent. I think it's really up there with the attention to detail, the typeface they use, the photography they commission, the illustration they commission. Also the size of it, it's 54 pages. It's very much a sort of 45-minute hour read. And then I do feel as if I can sort of put it to one side and move on. Other magazines, the Observer Food Monthly, for me, is still a supplement I look forward to. I've stopped buying the Observer every Sunday, but it is one that I'll look out for. If it's in there, I think, again, the typography, the photography they commission is excellent. I'm trying to think of the other sort of weekend magazines I will engage with on a regular basis. I've actually moved to read a lot of my daily newspaper is now read on the Kindle.
Mm-hmm.
So there is, it's always there if I need it, but I read it for the content as opposed to the design. But it's still, the supplement is still a thing, and I'll still hoard them for a little bit.
Right.
And then it'll get to a point where my girlfriend just sort of says, that massive pile of newspapers and magazines needs to go. And it'll be a recycling bag, and I'll quite happily sort of get rid and recycle.
Right. Rob, for you?
Yeah. So I think my equivalent to the FT would be the Economist.
Mm-hmm.
I pick it up. There's kind of maybe an hour and a half in there, and then throw it away and move on. But in terms of, a magazine that I would take out for a date, just me, the magazine, little cup of coffee, there's tons of them. But I just, so I went to raid Magma yesterday to check out some new titles which I've not seen before. And this one has really, really appealed to me, Smith Journal.
Yes.
And it was the first time that I picked it up. I know it's been around for a while. And it sort of feels like, I think it's aimed at men, but it's not like most men's magazines. And, it's great when on your first flick through, you just find a story that captivates you. It's a brilliant story in there, and a story that I've wanted to write for a while myself about what it's like in the Freemasons. And they've got this guy, this sort of whistleblower, who was initiated into the Freemasons in Australia in the 80s, and just tells this fantastic story of this bizarre sort of ceremony that he was put through and what it did for him in the end and things like that. So this is my new one. This is my new favourite, Smith Journal, I think.
And quite curious, you said, you think it's a magazine for men, but it's been brought to the newsstand by women.
Really?
It's the team behind Frankie in Australia. This is the, I don't know, is it the older brother or is it the cousin, the male cousin? But anyway, it's part of the Frankie family.
So maybe this is what I need, is I just need a men's magazine that's written by women.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's my ideal. Yeah, which is fantastic. It's just beautiful, full of really nice things and really good editorial ideas. They had one where they've done a series of interviews with people, but instead of taking photos of their faces, they've taken photos of their hands. So they've got a guy who was the first guy to do a liver transplant, and you can see his 80-year-old hands. And they've got a boxer who's got a finger missing because he cut it off to impress this girl who he later married. And he was going to have it sewn back on, but his dog ate it. And, I was gripped in Magma in 2 minutes. It's fantastic.
Now, aside from going on a date with yourself, with your own magazine, Will, what holds that status? Is you've got L Decoration, you were saying before we went on air, that's a bit of a guilty pleasure for you.
Yeah.
So is that just maybe sort of, coffee in the afternoon as opposed to a full, movie and dinner?
What I love about L Decoration, so whereas the FT Weekend is my sort of disposable, L Decoration is the accessible. It's the one, and when asked to bring in magazines for this, I looked at a whole array, and I ended up actually feeling quite uncomfortable bringing in certain fashion titles because I didn't know too much about them. I found it hard to sort of really get into them and engage. I read them in places like Magma, Artwords. There's a fantastic magazine shop just down the road from here where the design of it's lovely. But if you asked me to come in and talk about it, I would struggle. I'd just be like, I can't talk about the articles. I can't talk about those sort of things. L Decoration I can pick up, flick through, spend a couple of hours really enjoying either what the... And it's quite image heavy. It's and the articles, I'm trying to think, there aren't that many articles, but they are sort of accessible. I can engage with them. I can put it down feeling as if I've got something out of it. There isn't that sort of big barrier in front of it that kind of goes, this has been designed first to look beautiful and then to read second. It's very much look, read me.
Now, is there also a second level of hierarchy with your magazines? And just given, you know, what you do with It's Nice That, are there some that you have to preserve? You would never, ever consider ripping a page out of it. And then others, you don't mind shredding them.
Definitely. Usually it starts with one folded corner and then it's like, right, that's okay, I can now rip pages out. On the whole, yeah, I think damaging any sort of magazine sort of hurts a little bit. But I do stuff magazines in that my bag. I'm trying to think of those titles that I wouldn't sort of dare take anywhere, and they must be sort of kept preserved, or buy two copies and one stays in a shrink wrap. You'd have to come back to me. I can't, off the top of my head.
Are you a preservationist? And just given, you know, what you do with your title, so you mentioned The Economist earlier. Now, do you see a story and then go to The Economist online, or do you scan, or do you just rip it out and say, this is something maybe in a couple of months' time, it's a story we should go back and revisit?
I think probably the rule of thumb, it's probably a subconscious rule of thumb, is perfect bound, no ripping. Saddle stitch, rip away, not a problem. And so, yeah, I'll rip up The Economist, that's not a problem. And, you know, Sunday Times Magazine and, you know, Saturday Guardian and so on, rip bits out of that and turn that around. Anything, as soon as it's got, you know, a proper spine, I think that's a step too far.
It's absolutely fair game.
The quality, though, of iPhone camera now, I don't rip out as much. I will just sit there ridiculously trying to take a photo of the whole page on the sofa on a Saturday or Sunday. And it will just either find its way in an email to someone or an Evernote. It's rare that I'm ripping them out for that sort of reference anymore.
Mm. Okay, well, consider maybe what your top three, the ones that you would never, ever touch. We're going to go to Berlin now. Eric Speakerman is some of an A-lister within the typography community. His clean and elegant lettering has seen him enlisted by brands ranging from Nokia to The Economist. In 2011, he was awarded the German Design Prize for Lifetime Achievement, the German government's highest honor in the field of design. I spoke to Mr. Speakerman, Eric Speakerman, that is, with our creative director, Richard Spencer Powell.
I'm not so much excited by what I know. Obviously, I'm familiar, and I read obsessively. I read all the time, and I read a lot of periodicals. Or these days, I rather sort of diagonally scan them. You know, I still read my favorite old Economist because I redesigned it 10 years ago, and I read the Spiegel. But I'm always looking for new stuff. And surprisingly, there seems to be, at least in Berlin, a new magazine every week. They tend to be artsy ones, newsy ones, designy ones. And I tend to come back and spend €50 and buy new magazines and scan them. And I'm always excited that people get another approach at designing and writing for magazines. I'm really excited by it. It seems to be growing at the moment.
Do you think that's almost peculiar to Germany? Now, I know you're not just talking about new magazines in Germany, but you look at so many corners of the planet right now and you see this eroding shelf space. But you're absolutely right. When you spend time not just in Berlin, but in Hamburg and Munich, aside from really good specialist, you know, bookshops and newsstands, there is just this extraordinary love of print. And I'm wondering if you think Germany's a little bit of a peculiarity in terms of developed markets right now.
Yes, I think it always has been. As you know better than anybody, that we've always had a different tradition. We have only very few. Actually, we don't have really any national newspapers. We have a few, but by definition, they're called Süddeutsche, you know, Southern German or Frankfurter. So we don't have the Times or the Guardian or any other nationals. Our nationals tend to be the illustrated magazines like Stern or Spiegel, which are kind of newsy, but also a little more glossy. And those have never existed. The equivalent to Stern, for example, has always been the Sunday Times Magazine in a way. As far as ads are concerned, they've carried the ads. So I think we've always had more of a tradition of illustrated magazines since the 20s, which was the big time where things were printed gravure here in Berlin and Hamburg, other places. So I think we've always had more of a tradition of having a lot of popular magazines that weren't specialty magazines, like, you know, you have them for photographers or carpenters or stamp collectors. But we've always had two or three dozen of very, very popular magazines that I, to my knowledge, have never existed in Britain and not in the States either.
Eric, I'd just like to ask you just a quick question about legibility. You mentioned there that you still read The Economist, and there was a big legibility issue there. You improved that. When you look at this new sort of young, vibrant publishing scene that's in Berlin, do people still understand legibility? Is there still the craft of style sheets and making sure that every letter on the page can be read? Is that a skill that is going, or is it still very well understood there in Germany?
Well, I'm afraid it's a little underrated, because most of these Or could I call them journals or magazines, are very heavy on the visual side. And they're obviously very trendy, depending what the trend is. At the moment, the trend is to be sort of slightly messy and pretend not to know anything about typography. So use Times New Roman as the typeface or Helvetica for the headlines, which is, you know, supposedly a design decision. I think it's just laziness. To answer your question concretely, no, it is a craft that in that particular area seems to have gone. People tend to jump onto whatever bandwagon, and the bandwagons tend to come from New York or via London. So whatever somebody in New York uses for a typeface will be used here, and they won't go into check-in proper, you know, spacing and leading and stuff, because I think that craft is sort of equated with, you know, old farts like me. It's, you know, boring. I don't agree. I think it's easy. It should be like the engine room. You don't want to see the engine room, but you want to make sure it ticks properly. And these guys don't even have an engine room. So that would be my one criticism, that they're heavy on trend and very low on craft.
If we look at newspapers, and so often it's quite interesting, and oddly, radio has been a very interesting discipline, because often we look at front pages from around the world as they come in. And so it's incredible when you go through, you see a newspaper from the Philippines, and then you're looking at something from from Thailand, and then you've got all the Australian papers. You also see this default setting now, and most of us know what a newspaper should look like, but clearly there has been this, I think, rather odd creep of, okay, what does a web page, homepage for newspaper look like? Let's migrate that onto paper right now. And do you think that's, we've also, there is this laziness, let's make it identifiable and recognizable. It's one brand, doesn't matter if it's on paper or it's backlit. We apply the same design for both medium.
Well, I hate to say that I cannot really blame my colleagues that much. You're a client, but you're also, you know, you're a designer, you're a journalist, but you're also a client. Most clients, quite frankly, want more of the same. I've yet to meet newspaper journalists that really have guts. Most newspapers, especially newspaper people or magazine people, are very, very scared of the news, so they go for a tried model. They either repeat their magazine, or if they want to go into the electronic field, they will copy either their own magazine or somebody else's. It's very difficult as a designer to convince a client to actually dare leave the area they're comfortable with and try something else, because, I mean, everybody, including myself, we're all scared of change. Nobody wants to change anything. I hate my daily paper to change. But if you do, you can attract a different audience, because the old audience is dying out anyway.
What I wanted to know, is there courage there with your current clients? And I would imagine that hopefully you would only take on courageous clients. But have you also noticed a shift? I mean, as you said, you know, the times that we're in, they're shaky. But whether they're, you know, non-media brands or media brands, anyone that you're working with right now that truly excites you?
Yes, we have one particular client that's Red Bull, actually, of all things. I don't necessarily advertise their drink, but as a client, they're the best client we've ever had, because they know damn well if they don't stay on top, if they don't lead, they will disappear tomorrow, because there's no reason to drink that stuff other than, you know, being a cool brand. And I've never had a better client than those guys. These people really know what's happening, and they will risk things, and they will not plan for the next 5 years. They'll plan for a half a year ahead, because they know you can't plan any further. And it's probably the singular best client I've ever had, except for the people at The Economist. I keep mentioning that because they were bright people, and they were bright enough to know what I was good at and what they were good at. They wouldn't interfere with design issues, and I wouldn't interfere with their writing.
Does that mean that really surprise and serendipity are under threat? One of the classic problems, doesn't matter whether I'm at Frankfurt Flughafen or I'm at Heathrow, I am fed almost a pre-prescribed diet of titles which have been chosen, you know, by machine. Someone looks at the efficiencies, and that's all I get. And I think we all know the threat of that when one's range becomes so small. Does that mean perhaps there's a backlash on the horizon? We do get to a point that people want the full buffet rather than just the airline meal of media?
I like to take the view that the glass is half full rather than half empty. Books are becoming more like books. Paperbacks are going to die out, because who needs a paperback if you can read it on a Kindle? But, you know, books are now being seen more as objects. Magazines are seen more as objects. You have a change of paper, as in your magazines. You have people who really care about the insides and the outside. So craft is, at the same time, coming back. It may only be 10% of the market. But I can certainly see, as a backlash against the blandness, that whether it's in cooking or in restaurants or in hotels or in publications, there is this quality layer that may only be the top 10%, but that is certainly growing, and that's getting very exciting. And that's also where, quite frankly, the money is. You know, people who are into that sort of stuff don't mind whether they pay £8 or £9 or euros for a magazine.
Mm. Eric Speakerman in Berlin, thank you very much for that. You're listening to The Stack on Monocle 24. Rich, fascinating to listen to his view, and a highly quotable gentleman, incredibly talented and pithy. Working back from his last point, it's interesting how he talks about that 10%, though, and maybe that's where the world is. Maybe it does mean it is going to be a smaller bookshelf, or it's going to be a smaller book stand that we're going to be seeing, you know, on the horizon. Yet it's going to be of extreme quality.
Yeah, and I think one thing to add to that is you can't fake it. You can maybe fake craft, but you can't fake content. And you have to do them both to make it into that top 10%, I think. You know, to get a first, as it were, I think you have to have every department doing that correctly, from the design to the paper choices, to the content that you choose, and your total edit on the world. I think your product has to be, yeah, top 10% on everything.
Mm. It was also interesting how he was talking about the cowboy font, and maybe this harkening back to sort of the America West and the romanticism of that. And then, as you're saying also, there's a romanticism attached to, you know, maybe not that everyone harkens back to Victorian times, but it is certainly these anchor reference points. What do you think it takes for us to break out of that? Whether it's just, you know, the choice of font, or how do we also move beyond the current type of grid, you know, being above and below the fold as we see it on websites?
Well, I think Eric's got a point that people are scared, or they're lazy, or they're not brave. So I think we just need to address it and convince people that we need to kind of try something new. I think we'll become a bit oversaturated. I think we'll get a little bit sick of Victoriana and, you know, five different typefaces on a page. And I just think we need to readdress what modernism actually means, because I don't think it means what we all used to think it means. You don't see any sort of Bauhaus fonts out there, or you don't see anything really minimal anymore. Everything is a little bit overlayered, and I think we just need to stop. Take a deep breath and then have a think about it.
Mm. I mean,
and
Eric,
then maybe commission Eric.
Well, Eric did enough or gave enough plugs to The Economist, of course, a title which we like very much, though. But we just had our recent 2013 planning session. I don't want you to give away too much in terms of thinking about sort of, not that we're redesigning the magazine, but you know, the Monocle is always evolving. And you reference about Bauhaus. Do we move? Is that the obvious place that, you know, and whether it's our title or other titles as well, that we move into more of a modernist space? I imagine that, and it's great, Rich, to hear that he likes the way that you use Helvetica.
I know, I was very pleased. That's quite a compliment from someone that thinks it's like a Big Mac for a font. So, it was good. I learned a lesson there. I think we probably just need to take a real good look at what's out there and just analyse what you have. I mean, I don't necessarily think that we need to redesign typography and bring in a new font. You know, as he says, there's 200,000 out there and maybe only 2,000 are good. Well, you probably only need two or three to make a good publication, and that's you showing a bit of restraint. So I think we can pick three from 2,000, or anyone that's starting a new project can certainly do that. I just think it's quite interesting that everyone just seems to be looking back and not forward. And because I think he's right, it's harder to look forward. It's harder to come up with something new. And there are two approaches to it. His approach would be, you know, you should always create something new, as he references to product designers. And there's a counter argument that says there's 10 good typefaces in the world, and it's how you use them. It's not actually about the type itself. It's about how you use the type. And of course, I'm sure Eric would, he certainly wouldn't agree with that because of his theories of legibility, which are proven. So, I think it's just two approaches.
Richard Spencer-Powell, our creative director here at Monocle. Thanks for that Saturday graphic design tutorial.
No, it's fun. Thank you.
You're listening to The Stack here in London. We're back in a moment.
J.Crew understands that tradition and modernity often lie hand in hand. That often means looking back in time for inspiration, pairing the integrity of traditional design with modern desires to fit and comfort. As head menswear designer Frank Mauchin says,
We're always inspired by art, architecture, nature, and we look at classic historical menswear, vintage army gear, and those were garments with integrity because they served a purpose. To us, J.Crew is about understated masculine elegance, and we're constantly tweaking proportions to keep the fit current and modern without being trendy, and so we're always moving. What makes it modern, I think, is the fabric and the fit. It's like modern traditionalism almost. You know, like the details are traditional, and but then the fit, the fabric and the color, that's where you get all your updates.
J.Crew.
It's 11:48 in Stockholm, 10:48 here in London. You're listening to The Stack here on Monocle 24. Rob, I wanted to go over to your stack. It's also somewhat neatly arranged. Actually, it's gone a bit askew, though. But the title, well, what do you have on top there?
So I've got Slightly Foxed magazine, which is a beautiful quarterly magazine that comes out. And it's a book for people who love to read, but it doesn't review new books that have just come out. It goes to people who have something to say. So it goes to authors and academics and interesting writers, and it asks them to talk about their very favourite book of all time, which is fantastic because it's a bit like being in a conversation with a friend. Mm. And they're saying, oh, have you read this? Have you read that? And you get to get your head above the water of the day-to-day barrage of new reviews. Mm. And get to, you know, be told about something that was published in 1902 and is still available, you know, on certain pockets of the internet. You can find it, but it's been out of print for 80 years. And somebody loves it with a passion, maybe because they grew up with it, or because it meant something to them at some point in their life. So it's just a series of essays about brilliant books. And I love it. It's beautifully produced as well.
Then you've got Lapham's Quarterly.
Yes.
So for people who aren't familiar with it, where does that, you know, fall into the print landscape?
It's just very strange in a way. Because it's just a collection of extracts, and so, you know, they, on the back they say among the contributors, Jane Austen, Thomas Hardy, Larry David, Norman MacLean. You know, so what they've got, what they're selling, is a fantastic editorial board who can really kind of, you know, pull things from here, there, and everywhere, and it's done in date order, so you have things running from, you know, the 11th century up until recently. And it's brilliant. I just dipped into that one there, which I don't think is the latest one, and I read a letter that Charles Dickens had written to a friend about how much he hated his wife. And then I skipped on a couple of pages, and there was just an extract from an episode of Curb Your Enthusiasm where Larry David's dad tells Larry David that his mum died when he was on holiday, but that they didn't give Larry David a call because his mum had specifically said not to bother him on holiday. And it's just fantastic. You know, it's super eclectic. I mean, it's that serendipity thing. And, it's not, you know, a stunningly designed magazine. It's quite functional. Mm. But what a great idea.
Will, it was interesting listening to Eric Speakerman because he was talking about, you know, that maybe, you know, the paperback would go away. You know, why would you want a paperback? You can read it on the Kindle. That's going to give more currency to hardbacks. Is the paperback book threatened also because periodicals are becoming more bookish too, though? There's just this very sort of odd thing occurring on the shelf.
Yeah, I think so. I think I still think the Kindle is a certain audience. I still think there are a lot of people that enjoy the paperback. The battery never runs out on a paperback. We're certainly looking at the hardback, what we can do. And I think this December, we'll actually launch the first It's Nice That Annual, which is a hardback book of our online content. Because I think people are... One of the things that came out of the conversations we had with our readers were their shelf space is limited. Mm. They haven't got endless shelf space. And actually, if we can provide them one book, one title a year that has everything in, as opposed to trying to constantly feed them stuff to take up bookshelf space.
Right.
That's what we're going to try and do.
Because, yeah, it seems that a lot of people just have they might have links, but, you know, there's, as you said, no one's going to go back and look at and say, oh, I wanted to go read, you know, the May issue of that particular blog. And so, you know, I think a lot of web designers, they do have, you know, lots of A3 sheets of paper where they've just, you know, their snapshots of various sites. I've got Offscreen magazine here from Australia, which in a way does, you know, it is a celebration of the digital world, but in paper format. And your idea of doing this annual, was it just really sort of feedback from the audience, or even just the way you function within your agency as well?
It was feedback from the audience, but also it was a shift that we've tried to, in the last couple of issues of the magazine, avoid reprinting blog content, because we recognise the audience look at it and say, but I can go and look at that for free. So we've made a real effort to go, right, magazine content is magazine content, and we're approaching it like that. But it's now left this void that says we've published all this content online and it's fantastic content. And actually, to take the top layer, that going back to that sort of top 10% and everything, if we go and print the top 10% that we've printed, that we've covered online, suddenly you've got this really beautiful, accessible book that you can sort of coffee table book, stick on the shelf, revisit in 3 or 4 months or in a year's time. And I think it comes from those sort of things. And that's what we and the big challenge with this and the big thing that we're dealing with in the studio at the moment is creating this beautiful item, because it's going to cost more than a £10 magazine naturally. Right. So it's trying to find the balance of what are people prepared to pay for this, even though there's still that mentality that says, but I could go and bookmark all of these things and get an image folder on a website, on a desktop, and just look at them in my own time.
Well, do you think that's where a magazine like Offscreen becomes relevant? Because you know you still need this, you still need the analog to really chronicle, you know, whether it's design issues or, you know, and much of what they do as well is jumping into people's agencies too. And it perhaps it's one thing to have a slideshow of this is our team, but there's a certain texture and I guess intimacy when you look at, again, you know, the world of web design and production through a magazine like that.
Absolutely. It seems like a very nice way to feed back from the digital to the analog. And as you say, you know, what you get is you get the people behind it, you get the stories behind it, which is really nice. I mean, I guess something like this will have relatively niche appeal. Although I've not dug into it, maybe the stories are so great that actually they'd get outside of people who are kind of really interested in what the best agencies were doing.
Mm. Do you think frequency is also, in a way, a luxury at the moment as well? And I'm just holding up a favorite magazine of mine, which is called Sumu from Japan. Now, I don't read Japanese, but it is just so beautifully produced and takes you in and it's a series of contradictions, because it's high production values, it takes you into these incredible worlds, but it's very, very simple. And I just, there's one thing, I just love this, it's just incredible ink drawing of how to set up your perfect little Japanese kitchen, and then the magazine goes and does just a whole story about great outdoor kitchens, and you know, there's just page after page of this very sort of rural, slightly, you know, agrarian lifestyle, but elevated to such a level. But I go back to the point that it's quarterly, and I really like the fact that it's not thumping on my desk every month. And it's like, okay, and you do get to the point, it's like, I go to Japan, it's like, oh, wonder when the next one's going to come out. Do you think that, and we'll start with you, do you think some publishers sort of forget that? And you know, oftentimes we sort of drift to, you know, bringing, you know, to really sort of, you know, turning up the pace on either posting new things or going to the press more frequently.
Definitely. And I think we started by printing twice a year. We then went 3 times a year. We ambitiously tried to go quarterly, and it wasn't as much it sort of landing on the table or on the doormat every 3 months. It's actually being able to spend enough time to produce the quality content that you can consistently produce something of a high standard. And I think that's maybe one of the things. I think also it's, we talk about it a lot with online content, it's consistency. It's updating something regularly enough that your audience come to understand that. And actually, if you visit, it's nice that you know that there'll be 9 or 10 articles every day, and you know that they'll be posted gradually throughout the day, so you can revisit it, you can sort of expect new content. The magazine, if when you first pick it up, you understand it's a monthly, you're probably going to engage with it slightly differently than if it's a quarterly or a biannual.
Right.
And I think it's maybe just, it's the sort of the clarity in the audience understanding, right, this is a quarterly thing, therefore I know to look out for it in 3 months. Or I mean, one of the most frustrating things I find with magazines is when you go into a magazine shop and or into a newsagent's and discover that you've missed an issue or they've done something totally different. And we've sort of done that to a certain extent, which we've tried to be as open and honest with our subscribers in writing to them all and saying, look, we're not printing a September issue because we're independent. We have that luxury of sort of standing back and going, we don't need to force this issue to come out at this time. We're going to produce a fantastic magazine in March. And that's what we're really excited about. We're not just going to sort of rush one out because we're a biannual and that's what we're going
to
do.
Ed, just before we go, Rob, do you find yourself still having to sort of put the brakes on occasionally too, remembering that you're the slow journalism company?
I mean, the fantastic thing for us, we love the quarterly format, because when you look at news from 3 months ago, the brilliant thing is that you come up against these stories that were so huge for us that engaged everybody's attention, that everybody went wild about for 3 or 4 days, and then just sink without a trace. And actually, that's, you know, from the content point of view, it's fantastic. But from the reader's point of view as well, I completely agree with you. Once every 3 months is just about long enough that when it comes through your door, you think, oh, fantastic, I'd forgotten all about that. I do have a subscription to that. And you get properly stuck in. So for us, it works really well.
Great. Will Hudson of It's Nice That and Rob Orchard of the Slow Journalism Company, thanks very much for joining us on The Stack. Our show today was produced by Don Trump, and Adrian Craddock was our researcher. And our studio manager today is Ben Jay. If you have any comments or queries, do drop us a note to info@monocle.com. Coming up in about an hour and 2 minutes' time, Emma Nelson is going to be here. She kept me out way, way too late last night, so I hope she's feeling better than I've been feeling for this program. She'll be joined by Gillian DeBias. They're going to be bringing you today's edition of The Review. Of course, we've got a number of other programs. I'm going to be here tomorrow, roughly about the same time with our culture editor, Robert Bound. We'll be here with The Monocle Weekly. That's all from all of us here at the program. It's goodbye from London. And coming up in about 1 minute and 5 seconds time from now, we've got Georgina Godwin. She's here with the hour's headlines. Have a good weekend. Goodbye.
Vous écoutez Monocle 24.
Dobro pozdravljavat, Monocle 24.
Du lytter til Monocle 24.
Você está escutando Monocle 24.
Sie hören Monocle 24.
Akute Monocle 24.
Kuuntelet Monocle 24.
You're listening to Monocle 24.
A Rolex timepiece represents an ongoing commitment to innovation, horological expertise, and the passion of skilled watchmakers. All add up to make the one principle by which Rolex lives, that greatness is a journey that never ends. Rolex.